Presenter is Vicki Johnson Lawrence from the University of Michigan. And as soon as that comes up, you're ready to go.
So the talk I'm giving today is on household income and depressive symptoms in the Alameda County study, which took place from 1965 to 1999. And I'm looking at household income as a measure of socioeconomic position. An SEP provides information about a person's access to resources, and it can reflect the multiple aspects of an individual's ability to earn income. But currently, there are gaps in the literature that assessing the differential associations between variants of a single SEP measure, like income, in relation to health. And in the literature right now, there's information about individual income and household income and how they may be different in relation to health. And further, there is research that looks at income or SEP over the life course. So there's cumulative work, there's life course work, there's work that thinks about childhood SEP and how all those things are related to health, either at that time period or later on in life, but there's much less work that looks at SEP during the adult life course, so maybe from age 25 on, and looking at the variations in that time period until the health outcome of interest is being measured. So when we think about socioeconomic position in relation to depressive symptoms, what we first have to think about is what the prevalence of the actual disease is. So mental illness prevalence generally varies by subgroups of the population, including those defined by gender, race, ethnicity, or SEP. In particular, major depressive disorder prevalence differs by gender, and this data is from the National Comorbidity Survey, in which it showed that the prevalence of MDD is 8.6%, and this is, I think it's lifetime, it's 8.6% for women and 4.9% for men. Actually, I think it's annual, 12-month prevalence. And then depressive symptomatology is often higher for those of lower socioeconomic position. There are studies out right now that are looking at these measures over the life course, like the Gazelle study. And depressive symptomatology also varies by race ethnicity. So there's also a lot of current work out, especially among women, that shows that there are differences between white women and black women. And I'm quite certain it's also been shown to vary among other race ethnicities as well. So the research questions that I sought to answer were whether there was variation in adult household income pattern associations with depressive symptoms, and then also whether there were associations between static and long-term measures of household income over the life course with depressive symptoms. And the diagram that I'm showing in this slide is a representation of exactly that. So I'm proposing that young adult household income will impact in some ways older adult household income, and that subsequently there will be an impact on depressive symptoms later in the life course. The confounders that I'm adjusting for are age, race, ethnicity, and marital status. In the previous slides, I mentioned that gender is also likely a factor. So my overall analyses adjust for gender, but then I take a look further by gender to see what's going on. And then there are potential mediating confounders, which are the variables at the bottom that I'm interested in at least knowing the effect of in these models. And those include education, occupation, social isolation, social support, and problems with activities of daily living. The data used for this analysis came from the Alameda County study. This is a two-stage systematic sampling design to get information on a set of non-institutionalized adults from Alameda County, California in 1965. There were five complete waves of data collection. They were in 1965, 1974, 83, 94, and 99. The initial study design aimed to get information on 8,023 adults. They ended up getting information on 6,928 adults. And at each subsequent point of data collection, they attempted to recontact the entire sample with the exception of 1983, in which they attempted to get information from half of the sample from 1974. Ultimately, in 1999, 2,123 adults responded. And that proportion comes from the 1994 sample. 96% of the 1994 sample were included in the 99 sample. So the study population for this analysis included the 2,100 adults who had complete information on depressive symptoms, household income, age, race, ethnicity, marital status, gender, and education. Thinking about the previous talk, we have very little missing. So we did complete case analysis for these. So the statistical approach was logistic regression. And the exposures were household income trajectories which captured data from 1965 to 1999. Average household income using data or information from 65 to 99. And current household income information, which was collected in 1999. The confounders, as previously mentioned, that were adjusted for in these analyses were age, race, ethnicity, marital status, and then education and occupation are two of the possible mediating confounders or confounding mediators. And the risk factors were social isolation, lack of social support, problems with activities of daily living. And then there were a few additional variables that I'll talk about in a moment that were also considered in these analyses. The outcome was experiencing 5 or more depressive symptoms, and they were taken from the DSM-12D. This is from the PRIME-MD, which is essentially a tool that's used in medical practices to screen for depression. The items included feeling sad, blue, or depressed, loss of interest or pleasure in most things, trouble feeling tired out or low on energy most of the time, loss of appetite or weight loss, overeating or weight gain, trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, sleeping too much, more trouble than usual concentrating on things, feeling down on yourself, no good or worthless, being so fidgety or restless that you moved around a lot more than usual, you moved or spoke so slowly that other people could have noticed, and you thought about death more than usual, either your own, someone else's, or death in general. So for the first question that I was asking, I created or used statistical methods to create these income trajectories to capture people's income over their adult life course. So the procedure I used was a PROC-TRAJ program. It's a group-based trajectory modeling approach that was created by Bobby Jones and Nagin a few years back. And essentially it assumes underlying groups are in the population, and it has two parts. Really, the first is to determine the number of groups or the number of trajectory groups within your sample, and the second is to determine the pattern of each of those groups within your sample. And it links time and household income through a latent variable YITJ star, which is the potential for a certain household income using the equation on the screen. And in these models, I allowed the patterns to be or to follow up to a cubic or to have up to a cubic pattern. This slide shows the descriptive statistics by gender for the sample. And there were more men, first of all, there were more men than women in the sample, but there were more women than men with 5 or more depressive symptoms. More men had 13 plus years of education than women. There tended to be more whites in the sample, white men than black men in the sample. More men were married. More women were homemakers. More women had a history of depressive symptoms. Men had more social isolation as well as more social support. There were no differences on the problems of activities of daily living. And men tended to have more, or were more likely to be retired or reported being retired in 1999. But more women had loss of loved ones. Looking at the income measures, you can see comparing men and women that women tended to have lower income than men for all three measures, and it's what you would expect. For the trajectories, you can see that there are 6 groups and that women tended to be, or there were more women in the lower groups than there were men. For those trajectory groups, these are the patterns that they followed. I chose to allow 6 trajectories because when the analyses were run, first of all, you choose the number of groups based on the Bayesian information criterion and a meaningful number of groups. So that's a difficult balance to achieve, not only with the BIC, but in deciding what's really meaningful. And when we looked at the different variations of the patterns that the people in the sample followed, they essentially hovered around these 6 groups. Now, what I'll also point out is that the sample sizes for these groups are variable, especially when you begin to think about them by gender. So groups 1, 2, 3, and 4 are the lowest or had the lowest income consistently over the study period, but that captured the majority of the sample. Group 4 actually has the greatest proportion of the sample, 42.14%, and they were the highest of the lower groups. Then there are the two more variable groups, Group 5, which had consistently increasing income over the study period, and Group 6, which for the first four time points followed a quadratic curve and then leveled out from 94 to 1999. Also of note is that Groups 2 and 3 had the lowest income at the end of the study, even though they were not the lowest, they did not have the lowest income at the beginning. So the logistic regression models that were run for the overall sample were done separately for each of the three household income measures. Model 1 includes only the household income measure. Model 2 additionally included age, race, ethnicity, marital status, and gender. Model 3 included those measures in addition to the risk factors that I mentioned before, but also a history of depressive symptoms, retirement status, and loss of loved ones. So looking at models 1 and 2, you can see that generally wherever one was significant, so was the, or wherever model 1 was significant, so was model 2, but the associations were slightly attenuated, likely due to confounding. So what the results ended up showing, however, is that those in groups 2 and 3, which if you refer to the previous slide, groups 2 and 3 had the lowest income at the end of the study period. Those were the groups with the highest odds of depressive symptoms. Group 2 was the curve with the absolute lowest at the end of the study period, and they had the greatest odds of depressive symptoms, and that was true both in Model 1 and Model 2. Looking at the average household income measure, as well as the household income in 1999 measures, which were measured in quartiles, as you can see, those in the lowest quartile had the highest odds of depressive symptoms, and those in the second lowest quartile had the second lowest. So the patterns are consistent. They're, you know, consistent with what's being presented in the literature currently, but noting one other thing here is that the confidence intervals for the household income trajectory groups are much wider than those for either of the quartile measures. It certainly made me think about whether the sample sizes were an issue in those analyses. So, in looking at these models for men, you see a similar sort of story. Those in trajectory group 2 had the greatest or had higher odds of depressive symptoms, but the confidence intervals are really wide. For average household income quartiles, you see the wide confidence intervals remain. Same thing for household income in 1999, and the patterns are similar to those for the overall sample. And for women, similar story, but the confidence intervals are not nearly as wide, and that's likely because those groups are heavily composed of women. So the one thing that does stand out in these analyses, however, is with the household for model 3, the household income trajectory group 5, which was the one with the straight increasing pattern all the way, you know, from the beginning to the end, and among that group of women, you see the odds of depressive symptoms are higher. And mind you, these are all compared to that quadratic curve, and the reason they were compared to the quadratic curve was because that was the group with the highest income at the start of the study. And of course, I could have picked any comparison group, but that's how these were done. Seeing this result made me think about whether there may have been some relationship between women in the workforce or women earning income or the stress that they may have to endure in their careers and how that might be related to depressive symptoms. So all the measures were associated with depressive symptoms in the sample. The magnitude was greatest for those with the least amount of income, and the overlapping confidence intervals between the measures suggest the magnitudes may not be highly variable from one measure to the next, which is consistent with the literature, but I mean, I think it needs more investigation given the wide confidence intervals that we saw. I mean, it makes it easier for the confidence intervals to overlap, most certainly, but it's a reflection of the sample sizes within the groups of the trajectories and also likely the male sample size within those lower quartiles of income. And when thinking about gender, the short and long-term measures, just as before, were associated with depressive symptoms for men and women. And women with most increasing income throughout the study period had an increased odds of depressive symptoms. And remember, that was adjusting for a wide variety of risk factors for depressive symptoms. And again, the confidence intervals suggest greater sample sizes are needed. So the strengths of the study include that the study highlights there's possible variation in household income measures in relation to depressive symptoms. Now, this variation, whether it's due to sample size or whether it's really due to how we capture information over the adult life course about socioeconomic position and, for that matter, also about depressive symptoms, I think that warrants further study. It builds on the literature suggesting life course effects of SEP on mental health and identifies adulthood changes in SEP as potentially influential. I think in this data set, there were only 5 time points. So having very few time points may make it difficult to really investigate these trajectories and how they may be influencing health. And also of note is that whenever income is influencing health, it's likely health is influencing income. So recognizing that's a cyclical type of relationship, that's something that can be further adjusted for. And it suggests the need for additional study of income variability over the life course. So, and by gender, specifically. Women have a different pattern of income from that time, or from 1965 to now. They do not follow the same, or they don't necessarily have the same income or occupation backgrounds that men may have. And further investigation as to how those patterns play out is worthwhile. Limitations include that the data was self-reported, so this is all information that was given by the participants. There's limited wealth data, and for older adults, we know that wealth has a significant influence on their ability to take care of themselves, their ability to cover the costs of their health treatment, so that's something that also needs to be investigated. And one important limitation is that the trajectory models that were used here, although they capture variability about the samples and about the groups that they were meant to measure, thinking of a more specific way or a more systematic way to determine the number of groups and to capture the variability within that group in relation to the outcome is most necessary. So this trajectory approach, although it does allow us to group people together because they were similar in nature in their patterns, there are some people who are more similar to that curve the curve for the group that they're in than others. And including that information in predicting the outcome or in association with an outcome would help us really determine whether it's something about the patterns people are following or whether it just happened to be the grouping that they were close enough to in these analyses that made these associations appear in these analyses. Thank you.
We actually have a couple minutes left, so let me see if there's a question or two we might address over there.
So once
you come to the mic, so and if you would repeat the question for the recording.
So we asked if I considered urban, suburban, or rural residents in these analyses. And all of these people are in Alameda County, California. So it's a small, not small, but it's a reasonable geographic area. So we did not adjust for that means. In these analyses, yes.
Okay.
I was interested in what those trajectories of income looked like over the life course in comparison or in addition to average household income and the income in 1999.
Do you have any information or is the state including any information on parity, like how many children the man or the woman might have?
The data does have that information. I would definitely think that's a viable option, but these are household income measures. They're not individual income, so it would capture everyone in their household.
I want to ask a follow-up question about that. I mean, you're finding that it was the women whose household income was soaring were the ones with the most depression. It makes me wonder whether they were employed themselves, whether the women were employed, or whether it was their husbands that were bringing that information. Have you looked at that, or could you look at that?
I can look at it. So we adjusted for marital status, and in this sample, there were a fair number of women who were not married. So I'm wondering, we investigated. We looked at whether marital status was whether marital status among women was specifically associated with these depressive symptom patterns, and they appeared to be showing among women who were employed. So,
yeah, so I'm really concerned about their employment rather than their marital status.
It adjusted for both. Where it adjusted for occupation. And a lot of these women reported their occupation as homemaker. So I think you had the homemaker, the homemaker married group, And I think that in part was driving some of this. And then you have the employed single or unmarried women who also, or I think, were the other component of that group. But further, I mean, I could definitely look into it more.
I think back in 65 and 1999, there's just so little support for women who were trying to do a career and raise children. So maybe that parity would be a good thing for them. But that's just, you know, maybe a sub-study. But you've done a lot here. Very good work.
Thank you.
If you have one quick question, we can fit it in here.
What I'm saying is that it could be, there can be the stress associated with working that might have a bit to do with the depressive symptoms that we see among that group. That group five, that large, or that increasing trajectory, that was the youngest group of adults in this sample. And I didn't say